Only a lunatic would build a world-class resort on a ticking time bomb of molten earth. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast capturing nature's spectacle and presenting it as entertainment. Now, disaster movies about volcanoes are much like the lava-spewing mountains they depict. For years, the genre lies quietly dormant before erupting spectacularly into life when you least expect it. In 1980, we had Irwin Allen's all-star spectacular When Time Ran Out. We then had to wait 17 long years before magma-mad movie fans were treated to not one, but two volcano disaster movies, Dante's Peak and the cryptically titled Volcano. It was then another 17 years before Paul W.S. Anderson's CGI-fest Pompeii spewed its way onto cinema screens. However, on this show, we're looking at the most recent entry in this cinematic subgenre, 2019's Skyfire. To help me review the film, there was really only one man to call. He's the biggest disaster movie aficionado and enthusiast I know. It's Fred Anderson. Welcome back to the show, Fred.
Thank you. So many beautiful words there. Thank you. I'm blushing. I'm truly blushing. My Swedish humble heart can't really take it. You know, it's you know, I feel warm and you know, all that things. Thank you.
No, it's, as I say, it is always a pleasure to have you on. And on your last appearance, we were reviewing the aforementioned Irwin Allen classic When Time Ran Out. And on that show, or kind of after that show, you made me promise that if I ever wanted to review Skyfire, that I needed to have you on as a guest. So I'm glad that I could make that happen for you.
Yes. Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I'm really looking forward to dive deep into Skyfire. Well, there is some issues with that, though, but I will mention that later. But
yes, we're going to do a deep dive into one of the shallowest movies ever made.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know.
Now, we know that you are a big fan of the disaster movie genre. And the last time you were on, I asked you to explain the appeal of the genre to yourself. But, you know, this time I thought that I wanted to know a little bit more about your love and appreciation of the disaster movie genre. So I thought I would take the opportunity to ask you about what your favorite type of disaster film is. So is it ones with fires, floods, ones on planes or trains? You know, what is your favorite setting? What is your favorite threat?
It's a tricky question, you know, because most disaster movies are good or great in some one way or another. I prefer, though, movies involving earthquakes. I like when the disaster is grounded, no pun intended there, but I've always had a hard time and really enjoying disaster movies that are set in airplanes and submarines and tunnels. There is some good stuff there, absolutely, but it's not, you know, I want the epic feeling, epic disaster scenes. And I mean, volcano movies are you know, perfect for that, because a volcano often, you know, it gives away lava, earthquakes, some tsunamis,
clouds of ash.
Yeah, exactly, clouds of ash. You know, it has everything you need, basically. So I you know, but earthquake themed movies, and there aren't many of those, are often very, very good. I mean, I absolutely love I'm a bit ashamed now to say that, but I absolutely love San Andreas with The Rock.
Yes.
Because it's hilarious. And what is that? If not just it's earthquake porn.
Well, you need to we need to do another episode of this podcast where we look at a film from the year 2000. I think it's called Epicenter with Gary Daniels, and that features an earthquake and an exploding helicopter. I think it's the only film with an earthquake and an exploding helicopter. So it sounds like perfect entertainment for you, Fred.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. I love Epicenter, Gary Daniels and Tracy Lords, and it has stock footage from Metro, the Murphy movie. I remember.
It has stock footage from many movies.
Yeah, it has. But I remember the Metro scenes right now.
Yeah. I think you can actually, if you look close enough, you can actually see Eddie Murphy in that footage, such as. But yeah, they weren't. You know what? It'll do. No one's going to be looking that closely.
Looking forward to that. Epicenter it is.
Okay, I think it's time to get stuck into Skyfire. So let's try and work out what sort of accent Jason Isaacs is attempting.
Welcome to the most extraordinary and unforgettable experience available on this planet. Tens of thousands of visitors a month. We've only just begun.
Nature spectacle presented as entertainment.
I mean, only a lunatic would build a world-class resort on a ticking time bomb of molten earth, right?
The mountain's waking up. I need time to study it.
We're all going to be fine.
A young scientist invents a cutting-edge volcanic warning system and returns to the tropical island where her mother tragically died, hoping she can prevent future deaths. The island is now home to the world's only volcano theme park and resort, the brainchild of its reckless owner. Chaos soon erupts when the once dormant volcano starts to rumble. It's then a battle with nature to get off the island while fiery death and destruction rain down from the mountain. Skyfire was directed by Simon West of Con Air and Lara Croft Tomb Raider fame. In the cast, we have some Chinese actors that I'm afraid I'm not familiar with, and who, when I look them up on Wikipedia, they don't appear to be particularly famous figures in China either. If I'm doing someone there a disservice, then please drop me a line and let me know. For a Guaylo like myself, the most recognizable face was Jason Isaacs, who turns up as the villain of the piece here. Skyfire was released theatrically in China in December 2019 and was a box office number one there, but it pretty much went straight to streaming everywhere else, a kind of victim of the pandemic cinema shutdown as much as anything else. Critics were rather lukewarm on the film, and it has a user rating of 5.3 on IMDb. So with all of that out of the way, Fred, what did you make of Skyfire?
Well, I had a hard time now when you were reading the synopsis of the movie to not laughing out loud. You know, I was like bumping around in the sofa. But because what kind of story is this? A volcano theme park at an active volcano. I mean, only a billionaire madman would come up with that. Yes, there is. There's Jason Isaacs. I was thinking about that rating that it got. What did you say? 5 point something?
5.3.
You know, it's pretty fair, I guess. But I mean, in reality, it should be much higher. I mean, people are going into expecting some piece of high class art, fancy pantsy, you know, art house cinema for some reason. I don't know why. This is like the. Like you mentioned before, this is the shallowest volcano movie ever made. But it's shallow in a very comfortable, beautiful, beautiful way. You know, let me tell you, I've been watching this movie 4 times and I hardly remember anything from it.
It is a very unmemorable movie, but oddly, or maybe unoddly, it's actually... It's very enjoyable whilst you're watching it. It just doesn't sit in the mind at all. It's a kind of totally disposable movie. And it kind of reminded me of, I don't know if you had them in Sweden, you kind of in the UK, there used to be these old sweets called sherbet fountains, which were just basically a kind of cardboard tube filled with like sherbet. And, you know, it was just very, very sweet, very sort of sickly, but absolutely no nutritional content. And you kind of gobbled it all down. You kind of enjoyed it, but then you felt a bit sort of, you know, a bit sort of, that really wasn't the wisest thing to spend my time.
Yeah, yeah.
On.
I mean, I have similar thoughts. I would say this is the Oreo of volcano movies. You know, it's like you said, it's sweet, it's artificial, you eat it very fast, and then you kind of feel bad for yourself, but it was nice. I can't wrap my head around the Skyfire. I really can't, you know, because like you said, it's super entertaining when you're watching it. It's so packed with fun scenes and some actually quite exciting action, very, very digital action, but still well made. It looks crisp, you know, in the way that Chinese mainstream movies look. You know, it looks like it basically look like it's a computer animated, the whole movie, even the actors, everything looks lush and expensive, but you it's very, very difficult to remember what happens between the explosions.
Well, I think one thing to this film's credit, and as you were saying, that it does slip down very easily when you're watching it, is the fact that it doesn't faff about. I mean, it's only like 97 minutes long, if that, and within, I don't know, 5 minutes, the top has come off this volcano and we're in the midst of the action set pieces. So there, it kind of just, you know, gets up and running at full tilt very quickly, which I appreciated on one level because, okay, we're in the midst of things. But you know what, Fred? This film actually made me appreciate when time ran out more.
Oh, that's...
Because I wanted more of that beautiful beautiful melodrama that that we get in When Time Ran Out. And I guess I know that the kind of melodrama is is a kind of one of the favorite components of you for a disaster movie. So what I wanted to kind of find out from you is, you know, how well did you think that the melodrama worked here? Because in this film, kind of the melodrama here kind of centers on the relationship between Meng and her father, Wen Tao. And, Meng kind of blames her dad for failing to save her mother from the last time this volcano exploded. So what did you make of that element of the film? Did it kind of deliver enough melodrama for you?
No, I mean, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I, okay, I'm being mean here. Of course, it had a lot of melodrama, but it felt like everything with this movie. It felt quite shallow. I mean, I think it was pretty well written during those parts. I mean, the actors are good, but it feels like something someone wrote very, very fast, probably directly translated from a Chinese script along the way. And that, yeah, you know, it's kind of lost some depth along the way. Mm. But I don't, it's not bad, but it just doesn't touches me as much as When Time Ran Out.
Yeah.
You know,
It's very one dimensional, isn't it? The exactly. The relationship, as you say, feels like somebody rattled it off very quickly. And I kind of think that I found myself wanting a little bit more melodrama, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that made me think, you know, I think my tastes must be changing as I get older, because I don't think that 10 or 20 years ago I would ever be looking at one of these movies saying I want more melodrama. But I think that's now that I'm older, I think I appreciate those elements of these films much more. And that's what gives. And I think actually, you know, it's more than just my changing taste. I actually think, you know, what gives all of the action set pieces that more epic quality is the meaning, you know, if a character lives or dies, and that only comes from good melodrama. And so, you know, the melodrama heightens the set pieces, and the set pieces heighten the melodrama, because you're invested in the characters and whether they're going to survive or die.
Well, I'm totally with you on that. I couldn't have said it better. I was thinking about it, and if we need to compare two movies, it is When Time Ran Out, because they have similar themes. And When Time Ran Out have, you know, say what you want about it, but it has interesting characters. It has characters who have personalities. You can tell them apart, basically. There is some sadness in many of the characters in a way that feels very real, for being played by, you know, actors cashing in their paycheck. You know, it feels real compared to this movie. I often say that, I mean, the best slasher movies are not the slasher movies which, you know, skips on the drama. the best ones are My Bloody Valentine and The Burning and a few others, which actually develops the characters because you feel for them when they get killed or their friends get killed. And it's the same thing with disaster movies. A good disaster movies have good characters and good melodrama, like Earthquake or Towering Inferno or even Avalanche, another favorite. You know, it's you kind of care for them. There's some, yeah, it's sad when they die.
Do you think, I mean, there are a couple of moments within this film which made me wonder, actually, if there was more melodrama actually kind of in the script for this movie. And I wondered if there might have been a longer original edit, because there's another couple in this movie who are getting engaged. And they are incredibly thinly written to the point where you just think, well, why are they even being bothered to be included in the movie? And then there's a couple of odd moments where, you know, kind of we also meet that couple's granddad. And there's a whole business with a compass that doesn't go anywhere. There's also kind of like a reference to Meng's amulet, which kind of is presented as if it has significance, but we never sort of find out what the significance is. And it just made me, I don't know, they seemed like leftovers from perhaps things that were shot, but then not included in the movie. So I don't know. I mean, you've got the Blu-ray. Is there a whole host of deleted scenes on there? Do you share that impression that there might have been a longer cut of this movie originally?
When you start the Blu-ray, there's only one thing on the menu, and that's Play Movie. There's nothing else on it, you know. So, and that kind of represents the movie itself. There's nothing else than playing the movie. I agree with you. I haven't really given that thought that it could be longer. But now when you mention it, there is a lot of stuff that feels like, yeah, there was probably something more. I mean, the story itself feels more like it could have been like 2 hours or 2 hours, 20 minutes or something. But I think probably the Chinese producers felt, you know, okay, we need to boost the action. We have Simon West, the American, dirty American master director doing this, so we need to focus on explosions. Maybe that's so. This couple who got engaged, these are the ones swimming. They're underwater. They're underwater for like 10 minutes. I'm not sure how they survived that. I when rewatching it the last time, which was today, I was kind of hoping they would drown this time, but they didn't. So
now every good disaster movie needs a good douchebag, and that role here is filled by Jason Isaacs as the billionaire brain behind building this luxury resort on the site of an active volcano. My question to you, Fred, is: was there enough douche in his bag for you?
No, he could have been douchier. He's actually quite humane. He's like a human being, which, of course, now we were talking, you know, we like when there's depth and melodrama. But he's quite kind. You know, he's like a naive billionaire. I guess he's a billionaire, even if he's worried he will lose all his money because of building a volcano theme park. Though I have to say that I honestly think Jason Isaacs is the best actor in the whole movie. And he's still a bit, he's my favorite kind of actor in this movie. He's obviously cashing a paycheck, but he's trying to do something with it. He have this sadness. I use the word sad and sadness a lot in this episode. Sadness in his eyes, which kind of feels honest and real, you know. Yeah, but yeah, he could have been douchier. He could have been, once again, look at When Time Ran Out. Lots of douchebags in that one. We have the ultimate douchebag, and that's
Franciscus.
Yeah, exactly. He's fantastic. You know, it's superior actually to Jason Isaacs here, and I like Jason Isaacs. I do.
I felt that sort of Jason Isaacs needed to be. He definitely needed to be more evil. He needed to be perhaps doing something that, like, triggered the volcano or kind of risked the volcano exploding. I feel that would have added, a kind of a stronger dynamic to the film, because his arc kind of doesn't work, because, as you say, he's sort of too humane. So when he sort of has, you know, he's looking at his resort sort of being destroyed by the volcano and he's just sitting in a chair getting drunk. he then has this sort of moment of moral redemption where he sort of sees this video footage of a small child like crying in the puddle of ash. And he decides, you know what, I'm going to go and save her. And that kind of, because he sort of starts off as relatively humane, that doesn't really feel much of a journey for him to kind of, you know, doesn't feel much of a choice for him to make at that moment. So I feel they missed a bit of a trick there. But I wanted to also ask you about the end of Jason Isaacs in this film. And I wanted to put it to you that his death is perhaps the most stupid I've ever seen in a film.
Oh, right. Full disclosure. I watched it today, the last time. And how did he die? What happened?
Well, I think you strike on a very important point there, which is he's basically that he's standing on the dock watching that boat like disappear off into the distance. And he's sort of saying, I can't go because of my wife. And then it goes into the camera pulls back. So he then becomes quite small. But we then see like a massive rock splat down on where he was standing. And so we have to conclude that he's now dead. But it's so badly staged that I agree. Like you can almost miss that moment that he is now dead.
Yes. Yeah. So now when you mention it, of course, I remember it. But it's like, yeah, it's a very anonymous death. It's like no power at all in it. You know, he saves the kids and then he just stands there. You know, in a real disaster movie, he would try to push the kid back into the lava and then himself jump aboard the boat. And then the boat would get hit by, flying rock, you know. Of course.
Perfect.
But yeah, that would be like, you know, but with other rich people there. But I agree. That's kind of an anti-climax with his character.
Yeah, because compare it to, you know, this film, which I'm now becoming to realize is an absolute classic of the volcano disaster movie. Compare Jason Isaacs' deaths to James Franciscus's death in When Time Ran Out, where he's standing on the balcony looking at the erupting volcano as this massive chunk of rock hurtles towards him. I mean, it is a brilliant moment of drama. If you're going to kill off your kind of main douchebag, I mean, that Irwin Allen absolutely nails how to do it in that film.
Yeah, I'm getting goosebumps now when you mention it. And that's the mirror scene also, yeah.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so he forces her basically to stay with him there. And it's so – that scene alone in When Time Runs Out has more drama, melodrama, than the whole Skyfire, you know, for sure. I mean, really. Oh, it's such a masterpiece. Okay.
One thing I wanted to we definitely need to talk about the – set pieces in this particular film. So, you know, that's the kind of the way these films ultimately live and die. How did Skyfire deliver on that front for you, Fred?
I think it delivered quite good. Of course, it's a lot of digital effects. I mean, the whole movie feels CGI, but it's pretty well made and the action is tense when it happens. There's a lot of speed in it. There's a lot of people flying in all directions. I like that. But I say that the main eruption up on the volcano is, I mean, it's the highlight action-wise of the whole movie, because that's something I always will remember, because it's so packed with ridiculous moments. And you never, when you see it the first time, you have no idea how this is going to end, you know, because it's silly, but it's silly in a way that works, you know. And it also feels like, yeah, there's a lot of digital explosions, but it also feels like there's quite a lot of real explosions, of course, because it's Simon West, so things needs to explode. And I always appreciate when you see the real fire, you see the real debris flying, you know. Yeah. I mean, I dig it. It's shallow, stupid, but I dig it.
Well, you bring up Simon West, and he was somebody I wanted to talk to you about, because we all know there's a lot of money in the Chinese film industry, and you know, with a checkbook that big, they could go out and get anyone they want. But rather than sign up Martin Scorsese or even Bellatar, I mean, you know, go in whatever direction you want to go here, they go and sign up Simon West or Rennie Harlan, who has worked in the Chinese film industry recently. What does that say about the Chinese film industry, Fred, that, it's Simon West and Rennie Harlan that they go out and get?
Yeah, I would say that they have a sense for entertainment, you know, maybe more than, I mean, at least these big mainstream movies. They understand that this is, they think at least that this is what the audience want. And Simon West, I heard he's a quite troubled guy. People don't like to work with him, so maybe that's why he ended up in China. But I think he's done a couple of decent movies. I mean, Con Air is stupid, but it's fun. And I'd like to dare to say that Expendables 2 is better than the first one. I know that's a controversial statement, but even if it's less gory, it has more intense action, you know, more, it feels crisp in a different way. The first movie, which I enjoy, feels more sluggish, more Stallone-ish. The second one is just massive and violent without getting bloody, really. I kind of miss the gore in it, but you know, I can't have it all. I notice here when scrolling IMDb and Simon West that he did a Chinese movie 2021 about tomb raiders. It's some kind of treasure hunters set in Russia and China, I guess. And I gotta see that one. You know,
plagiarizing himself.
Absolutely. Oh, he looks like, have you seen his IMDb photo? You look at that guy. He's so happy with himself. Anyway, yep.
Now I saw on Wikipedia, which is always 100% accurate, that Skyfire was intended as the first of a trilogy. Ooh. So Fred, you know, you find yourself in a lift with, you know, one of Hollywood's biggest producers who says, you know, well, you know what, maybe we should make Skyfire 2. You know, what are you going to pitch to him as your ideas for the plot of Skyfire 2?
From the rubble crawls severely burned Jason Isaac. He's gone mad after this disaster, but he still have money and he's good at manipulating financiers around the world. So he creates a chain of volcanoes around the world, you know, like a franchise basically of volcano theme islands. So they kind of trigger the Earth's core to spew lava. You know, great idea, will earn a lot of money. But of course, something goes wrong, you know, as you can imagine. What do you think about that?
I like it. It's very much of that sort of Jurassic Park, Jurassic World type scenario where despite the evidence that this is a terrible idea, you know, creating an island filled with dinosaurs, that they inevitably go ahead and do it again in the sequel. Like nobody learns any lessons. I like that you're sort of, yeah, taking that idea and transplanting it to the volcano disaster movie genre.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said, because I sound so old and wise, but I always said that Skyfire is like Jurassic Park, but with a volcano. You know, it's basically that. You switch the dinosaurs to a volcano. So I would love to see a worldwide volcano movie, you know. And, you know, Jason Isaac, like I said, he's burned. He's probably have some cool mask that he removes towards the end, you know, maybe half the face. You can see the skeleton underneath, basically, something like that. I like that. So Simon West, if you hear this, or Rennie Harlan, if you want to take over the franchise, please contact me. Contact us too. We can do it. We can write it.
Well, I'll give you my idea for Skyfire 2, and I'll see what you make of that, which was there's only one place that all franchises end up eventually, and that's in space. So my idea was that sort of in 2050, humans have colonized Mars. And, you know, perhaps all paid for by a now older Jason Isaacs. I like the idea of bringing him back. On, you know, basically kind of the process of colonizing Mars triggers the sort of dormant volcanoes there. So we then have volcanoes in space. And so it's now a race against time to escape the volcano and get off Mars. What that's do you think about that, Fred?
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I say that this is a couple of years into the Mars civilization, so they had time to build some cities, and maybe they found some water at the Earth, you know, Mars core or something like that, so you can have some kind of flooding also. I always love a good flooding in volcano movies, you know, something like that. But yeah, great. I can see the tunnels under Mars crust, you know, filled with lava, and people are running or in some kind of vehicles escaping from the lava. Yeah, I'd love to see that. Great idea.
Okay, I think we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Alaska, sole survivor of the law enforcement wars waged during the fall of our world. John Travis, special police, hand-to-hand combat specialist, karate cop.
Oh, cops are dead.
This one's still kicking.
And this one will soon hold the key to the future in his hand. A crystalline rod, a conductor of light to beam mankind's last hope of freedom to a new world.
These are the freebies.
For in this distant medieval mutant wasteland, there is no hope. There is no freedom. Slavery will be their future. The warlord will be their god.
I'll do it. I'll get what you need.
You are a lucky man.
Time ran out once before. It's running out again. Now is the time for mankind's fragile second chance, and the one who swore to serve and protect, Karate Cop.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs after the volcano begins erupting. A helicopter swoops down to pick up two of our heroes when it is hit by a thermal blast that suddenly shoots up through the rock. The chopper spins off out of control. Our heroes have to leap onto a winch and over a cliff in order to avoid the copter before it then falls to the ground and crashes. There's a brief pause so our heroes can make it to a safe distance before the wrecked helicopter explodes. Fred, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I actually did a review of this explosion and crash to my partner here, because I was sitting and watching the movie, and he covered the cat's eye and said, "Don't watch this. This will damage your brain." And then I had to explain why I was watching it. I really like this helicopter scene. I do. Yeah, once again, it's all CGI. But it's so chaotic. I like when helicopters get out of control. You know, they're like spinning. You know, you have no idea where it's going to end up. And also that it kind of chases these people. You know, they're throwing themselves off the cliff, hanging on the side. The helicopter comes spinning after them like a shark. You know, the great white nibbling their feet, basically. And then crashes down with a big, large, heavy thump, and they run from it. For some reason, they survive this, and they run, and you have this explosion in the background. I love this. I really do. Maybe I sound naive and uncritical, but this is my kind of helicopter explosion. It is.
I think it is definitely one to enjoy. I don't think you should feel any shame in enjoying the exploding helicopter in this particular film. I don't think you should ever feel shame for enjoying exploding helicopter. That presumably goes without saying. But this one is a good one for all of the reasons that you lay out. It's a really sort of nicely put together sequence with there. You know, it has multiple moments of jeopardy for the kind of the two characters. You know, they're being chased by the out of control helicopter. Again, like you, I love out of control helicopters. I love to see pilots, you know, frantically wrestling with the controls, you know, alarms going off in the cockpit. I love all of that. As you say, they then have to leap over this cliff in order to avoid the kind of spinning copter. And then they're still not safe because the wreckage kind of nearly hits them when it crashes to the ground. And then they have to run for their lives in order to avoid the explosion. So, you know, as I say, multiple moments of jeopardy, a terrific sequence. I loved the exploding helicopter in this film. My only one kind of thing that I can really point out as a flaw in this particular scene, it felt like there was a shot missing because we see them running away and then it goes to quite a long shot. And so the explosion actually is only quite small in terms of the kind of the perspective of the whole screen. It feels like you needed that more cliched shot where, you know, they're running towards the camera and there's a big explosion in the background that sort of fills the whole screen. We don't kind of get that classic sort of, you know, heroes running from an explosion type shot. And I don't know why that's missing here. I mean, Simon West must have done that shot a million times already in his career.
Maybe what's missing there is that the swimming couple comes out from some hole there and there's some drama, you know, and they probably involve this compass or something like that. And, you know, and they felt, oh, it's too much, and they just cut it away. And that's why it looks like it does now. Though I'm just joking, of course. But though I like this big white shot at the end. It feels epic. You know, it's like they're running on the side of the volcano and you see this explosion. I think that was quite beautiful. But yeah, you're correct. You're the exploding helicopter guy, you know, the go-to guy. So yeah, I agree. I will correct myself and say, yeah, it should be more running from explosion. Definitely.
I don't mean to intimidate you with my reputation in the exploding helicopter genre, Fred. That's not
thank you. I feel better now. But you know, this whole set piece is amazing. I mean, just not the helicopter, but the whole thing on this elevator thing they're going into the volcano with, and the monorail sequence is like, what the heck is this? This is insane. That's like I mentioned before, this whole scene is the highlight of the movie. It's like it's parody almost.
I do, yeah. The monorail sequences are fantastic. I really enjoy the particularly the transfer between the two monorails. A delightfully stupid moment. And I love the guy who gets hit, who jumps and hits the pole. There's a brilliant sound effect for him hitting that pole. It really makes you feel that impact as his body hits that.
I'm laughing out loud every time I see it. Be honest, it's like we know it's gonna happen, but you know, when it happens, it's like perfect. And also they get what do you say, the gravity inside the monorail. They're kind of floating around in air. I can't find the word now in English.
Aerogravity.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Beautiful.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Fred, thank you for joining me once again to talk about films where helicopters and volcanoes explode. And before you go, would you like to take a minute to tell people where they can find you online or plug any of the projects that you're involved in at the moment?
Well, you find me easy. It's if you like movies, check in my Instagram, which is Schmollywood Babylon, or join me on Twitter as Homo Satanis, where it's like movies and UFOs basically nowadays. that's where you can find me, and you're more than welcome. And I'm one of those good guys that follows back.
As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website, explodinghelicopter.com, for more reviews and information about films where helicopters explode. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Letterboxd. If you can leave us a review on your podcatcher, we'd be incredibly grateful. It helps us out. It helps us get the word out there. We'll be back soon. But until then, what should people do, Fred?
Keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
I mean, only a lunatic would build a world-class resort on a ticking time bomb of molten earth, right? Wrong. There is no chance of this beast howling again for at least 150 years. And they all know that too, but they don't want to be reminded of it. Because today's tourists want to live life on the edge. They want to bungee jump over rivers full of crocodiles. They want to eat poisonous blowfish in Tokyo. They want to feel like they're dancing with death, living life to the full, all the while knowing that in fact, they're perfectly safe. And that is why Tianwo is the must-see destination for the selfie generation.